Could it please the court?
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Dan Rector. My bar number is 7568. And I'm here with my co-counsel, Tanya Melnichenko. And we represent Ms. Jackson, Ms. Cooley, and Ms. Chalmie, all who are American Family Insurance. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if possible. The reason we're here and the reason we've raised this before the court is because under the status of the Hicks case, at the time it was dismissed, none of my present clients on this particular matter, and likely thousands of others of American Family Insurance, would have ever been advised that they were either in a certified class of American Family Insurance, or more importantly, that they were to receive the extended benefits that were now incorporated into their policies under the former no-fault statute 10-4-7-10-2-1.
Help me understand one procedural anomaly here. Mr. Hicks' claims were settled and dismissed, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. How can he continue to be a representative of the class if he's dismissed?
We don't believe he can, Your Honor. That's something of the predicate of our case.
Does the court's order of dismissal as to his individual claims say anything about whether the case is also dismissed or whether he's somehow empowered to continue to act on behalf of the class?
It did not, Your Honor, and I thought that was very, very important in the way we presented this, because when we went to the oral argument almost a year ago to the day in front of Judge Sandstedt, class counsel offered what I thought was somewhat a tepid argument that Mr. Hicks remained as the class representative. Well, I see a couple of problems with that. Procedurally, the case was dismissed, and I don't think there's any dispute about that, and I'm a little taken aback that there was an argument to the contrary. Because,
well, excuse me, you said the case was dismissed or Mr. Hicks' claims were dismissed?
Oh,
there's a difference.
Well, the case was dismissed.
Period.
Period.
Okay. So then you're seeking to intervene in a case that has been dismissed.
That's correct.
What, do you have any authority that a putative class member can intervene or move to substitute after the case has been dismissed?
I believe in the American Pipe case, Your Honor, the one that's something of the seminal case on the issue of class action tolling. That is addressed, and I think the logic is rather compelling. What it says in American Pipe is, in effect, you don't have, to say, be sort of pedestrian about this, you don't have a dog in this fight until what occurred here, which is the dismissal. You see, up to this point, Mr. Hicks was in a position to carry out the needs for the class members. And we're not even specifically taking issue with the fact that he prosecuted his own case, although the case law suggests that he is presumptively no longer adequate once he settles his own case. But whether that's a presumption that's irrebuttable or not, he settled his own case and then he dismissed the entire action. And therefore, he wasn't meeting the needs of the entire class. But
how was this case dismissed without compliance with Rule 23E?
Well, that's another issue we raised in our opening brief, Your Honor. We don't know how, because it was our position and is our position that at that point, even with Mr. Hicks pursuing his own case, if he intended to reserve his continued representation of the class, even with the cloud of having settled his own case, he should have gone to the court on either a fairness hearing styled situation or at least some presentation of evidence and indicated why there was some reason to be dismissing him. But there's no indication whatsoever that 23E was followed at all.
Well, one understanding might be that he wasn't trying to dismiss the class aspect of the case, but only his own claims, although I know the order doesn't seem to suggest that. But that seems to be what his counsel thought, and it seems to be what Judge Sandstedt thought when you were before him at that hearing.
Well, the reason I question that, Your Honor, is first of all, procedurally, if you look at the court file, the case is dismissed. It just simply is, and that stipulation of dismissal was just that. The other thing I would say, but somewhat rhetorically, if that were true, why was there absolutely no activity on that case after Mr. Hicks dismissed his case? None whatsoever. And then, even after we raised this issue at a hearing 1 year ago, there hasn't been any additional activity on this case. So when class counsel goes in front of the trial court and protests that, well, in fact, they felt they continued to represent the class adequately, not only was the case dismissed, but there wasn't any activity suggesting that. So I think it's a disingenuous argument. If they had filed something saying, well, Mr. Hicks settled his own case, but we continue to represent the class vigorously, and we're going to engage in some vetting process here. Now, mind you, our request was not an exhaustive one. We didn't take any issue with the fact the class was certified, the scope of the class period, the definition of the class, the notice, not even necessarily the method by which the class was to be notified by mailing. But what we did take issue with was the fact that our clients were clearly not being notified. And we didn't do that merely anecdotally. We presented the trial court with some documentation. The first thing we did was we presented Mr. Pohl, who was a class administrator, someone chosen by the class counsel and then engaged by American Family. We gave him a list of the persons that we represented, and he gave us an affidavit, which we presented to the trial court, indicating in so many words that roughly half of the people listed were not on his list to send, to whom he should send the notice.
But how were those people in any way affected by the sending of notice? I mean, this was a 23B2 class, correct?
That is correct.
And a 23B2 class where injunctive relief is sought doesn't bar or preclude claims of anybody, as I understand that. I think it's the Hahn case or John case that you cited.
Absolutely, it does
so
not.
Any of these people who didn't get notice are not affected in any way that their claims against the American Family would be barred. Your clients or the other 10 clients that the plaintiff's lawyers represented later.
Well, I certainly endorse that conclusion, as you might well imagine, Your Honor, but what's sort of interesting in that regard is then American Family comes out and starts protesting about statute of limitations and things of that matter when the notice wasn't provided.
But those are matters for other courts to decide down the road. I don't know that Judge Sandstedt had to decide any of these, or that we do.
No, but here was my point. I understand under 23B2 you don't have to provide notice, but the judge did. And so under the circumstances, it seems like that issue has already been taken care of. He said, we're going to provide notice, and we're going to provide notice to these people in mailings. But let me retreat somewhat to my original point, and that is, once that decision was made, then they had to establish a mailing list. Now, what American Family did somewhat preemptorily was they created a mailing list that was not exhaustive. The class definition is rather clear. There's no subjective nature to it. You're either in or you're out, and you're supposed to be getting a mailing. Now, whether it goes to a bad address or an outdated address is not why I'm here. It's how many people were on that list to get the notice. And what American Family did was they created a too restrictive list based upon a somewhat self-serving definition of whether or not they think people would have needed additional benefits, 50,000 in medicals expended under basic PIP, wage loss under 1 year. Well, we have clients who are $33 shy of $50,000 in medicals, and they were not on the list to get the notice.
But you can bring suit on their behalf.
I beg your pardon?
You can sue on their behalf.
Well, indeed we have, and we will. But here's my point, Your Honor. Even Judge Sandstedt raised this point, which we considered a very difficult one to rebut in its purest sense. He said, well, your clients now know because you're sitting here representing them. And I guess axiomatically that's true. But what then are we supposed to do for the absent class members? And I think we return to sort of the rubric of the whole class action milieu, which is you have persons out there who are not being notified simply because they weren't identified to be notified. And what we provided to the trial court was not only the affidavit of the class administrator who said, these names that you gave me, roughly half, are not on the list. But in addition, when we sent letters of representation to American Family and said, we represent these persons. We weren't asking for money, anything else, just to let them know so that we could review their PIP files. We received back payment on 107 different persons who were not on that list, but were entitled to payment just by virtue of the fact they were identified, because there's a dissimilarity between the extended PIP wage loss payment during the first year and the basic PIP wage loss payment. So we did everything we could in our power from the outside looking in to provide the trial court with a, in essence, a prima facie showing that there was something amiss in the aggregate of number of people that were to be notified. And we fully acknowledge that that knowing as they do that they now have these benefits, they have the right to prosecute a civil lawsuit. But what we're saying is, if the standard is, well, anyone who wants to replace Mr. Hicks is now ineligible, in effect, because they already know they have the coverage, then there's no protection for those absent class members. What happened here was that once Mr. Hicks settled his case, there then was no protection. That class was abandoned, the absent class members, and there should have been some checks and balances on how that occurred. And all we ask was to replace Mr. Hicks as a class rep and replace class counsel under the, I guess, the fair presumption that they were no longer interested in this project. They had dismissed it. And then to conduct the discovery that would affirm or deny that there was a sufficient identification of the potential class members.
Was your motion couched in terms of Rule 24 intervention?
Yes, it was, I believe.
A or B? Permissive or as of right?
You know, I'll confess, I think it's a B, but I don't recall, Your Honor, and I apologize for not having that knowledge. All right. I see that I've not even preserved the 5 minutes I had hoped to. I will certainly answer more questions at this time. I would like some rebuttal time, however.
Would you look at the American Pipe case while you're listening to opposing counsel's argument and be prepared to address specifically how that would allow you to intervene in a case that's been dismissed?
I don't have it at counsel table. I'm familiar with it, Your Honor. I'll try and address that as best I can.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Peter Gregory on behalf of American Family Mutual Insurance Company, registration number 10928. With me is Bob Harris. I am going to endeavor to complete my remarks in about 10 minutes and yield my remaining time to Pat Vallone, who is class counsel representing Mr. Hicks. Now, in some respects, our interests are somewhat aligned vis-a-vis this motion, and by the same token, our interests are adverse, so you may hear different things between Mr. Vallone and I. Let me clear up, well, let me make a preliminary statement here. I'm reminded of the Dutch artist M.C. Escher, and what we're really dealing with here is a matter of perspective. Each side sees this case just a little bit different. For example, what we're really looking at here is a motion for substitution, not intervention. In actuality, if you really look at it, Judge Sandstead allowed the interveners to intervene, heard their arguments, and then denied the motion for substitution. Secondly, the motion for substitution was premised on a number of misstatements, a few of which I'm going to address in a minute, and bald assertions which were not supported by the evidence. I'm not going to use my time detailing that list, but I would commend the court to look at page 17 of my answer brief, where I listed in detail, I think, seven misstatements of fact, and I address them in detail in the statement of facts in the brief. Let me, however, identify a few which are critical and which the court, in fact, has raised. The case was not dismissed. If you look at Judge Sandstead's order, the dismissal was as to Mr. Hicks' individual claims.
Is there anything in that order that clarifies Mr. Hicks' entitlement to continue as a class representative, notwithstanding dismissal of his individual claims?
There is not. It is just a one-sentence order.
Wouldn't it be a reasonable presumption, looking at class action law generally, that if the class reps' individual claims are dismissed, we need a new class rep, just as we've got cases that, for example, class reps have died?
Right. And I think that question is better addressed to Mr. Vallone.
Okay.
But I would say that, in fact, Mr. Vallone's brief cited to the court cases that address whether the settlement of the named class representatives' individual claims, in fact, does preclude them from continuing to act as a class representative, and the cases say it doesn't necessarily.
All right, I'll leave that for him then.
Now, the fact of the matter is, Mr. Rector indicated that there was no activity by class counsel. That may be true if you look at the court record, but the fact of the matter remains, and this is set forth in the briefs, that after Mr. Hicks' individual claims were dismissed, that class counsel came to American Family in response to the fact that the initial mailing in May of 2007 had generated a number of returns, and I'm going to address that mailing in a moment and the genesis of that mailing, but it had generated a number of returned pieces of mail, and class counsel requested American Family, and American Family conceded, to pay additional monies to run those addresses, that class list, through a more effective address finder. And ultimately, additional notices were sent by the class action administrator, and I think, as reflected in the briefs, that the ultimate rate of return of about 10%, or rate of undeliverability of about 10%, the class action administrator acknowledged was within the normal realm of what would happen in giving a class notice. So there continued to be activity. Mr. Hicks, through his counsel, continued to pursue the class action even after his individual claims were settled.
Is any of that in the record, in the trial court record, as opposed to divergent statements the counsel are making in their appellate brief?
It is in the record insofar as I believe you look at the arguments that took place in March of 2008 before the trial court. It's in the record in that regard.
In the form of statements of counsel,
yes,
not evidence.
But not in the form of evidence.
I guess my problem with what the implication in your argument is that everything was above board in terms of the notice process is that would seem to be a factual issue that ought to be addressed by the trial court based on an evidentiary hearing. You know, if we conclude that the class rep, there should be substitution of a class rep. So I guess I'm not sure where your argument gets us, since essentially we have no factual record.
Well, except I think we do, Your Honor, and that is if you look at the transcript of the argument that took place before the court,
okay,
there were a number of facts that were put forward before Judge Sandstead. And what I'd like to do, I want to talk a little bit more about the notice and then come back to his ruling, because I think his ruling really does make the factual determination. There's somewhat of a misnomer here. Mr. Rector insinuated that American Family had prepared a mailing list which was not exhaustive and which was unduly restrictive. You need to know about the genesis of that mailing list, and this is set out in our brief, and that is that in December of 2003, after the last then pending class action certification had been denied, American Family instituted what it terms a voluntary reformation program. Initially, in January, February, March of 2004, the claims staff of American Family undertook an internal review of open PIP claims, determined if that claim had incepted at a time when the requisite optional coverage had not been offered, and internally reformed policies and provided the extended PIP coverage to insureds. And so there was a lot, and this is covered by the affidavit of Alice Kissling, which is in the record. There was a large number of files which were internally reformed and additional benefits paid. In May of 2004, the determination was made to address closed PIP claims. And it was at that point that a mailing to approximately 17,500 people went out. And the way that American Family determined who would be on that mailing was it selected criteria which it believed would identify those people who would most benefit from reformation. It ran those criteria through a computer, and it generated a list of 17,500 names, and the letters went out. A number of the letters were returned, and it turns out that Mr. Hicks was not a recipient of one of those letters, and that was what led to the filing of the Hicks case in June of 2004. Fast forwarding now to when it's time to give the notice, and as Judge Richman pointed out, we must remember this is a 23B2 case. Because of that, whether notice is given and the scope of notice is a matter within the discretion of the trial court under the Air Communications case. Air Communications, which I've cited in my brief. At the hearing in March of 2007 on the contents of the notice and the scope of the notice, the class counsel and American Family took divergent positions as to who should get the notice. The hearing concluded with Judge Sandstead saying all 17,000 potential members of the class should get the notice. What then happened was that the mailing list generated in 2004, which had generated the 17,500 names, served as the mailing list for then the class notice and attempts to reach more people whose addresses had become stale. And so that's the genesis of the notice. Now, if we move forward to the motion for substitution and the notice and the arguments therein, what Judge Sandstead determined is that indeed, that's what he had ruled, that the notice should go to the 17,000 potential members of the class, but he also factually found, after argument by all counsel, that if there was a continuing dispute as to the notice, that the attorneys who represent the class now can do what they think is appropriate. So he determined that class counsel, as well as class representative, Mr. Hicks, continued to be adequate, and that they could continue to pursue any issues that they needed to vis-a-vis the notice. I'm at 5 minutes now. If there are no further questions, we would request that the trial court's order denying the motion for substitution be denied, or pardon me, be affirmed.
May it please the court, counsel. Patrick Pallone, and with me is Joseph Archuleta, appearing on behalf of Chad Hicks and the plaintiff class. It is our belief that the appellant intervener's appeal is really the product of two things. One, an artificial characterization of the record below in the district court, the case in which intervention was sought and substitution was requested. And secondly, a misapprehension of CRCP 23 procedure and substance. Perhaps a good place to begin with regard to the first issue is a timeline of the events that have occurred in the court below.
Maybe you should start by answering Judge Webb's question about the notice of dismissal and the order of dismissal. Was anything preserved of this case, or was it all entirely dismissed?
Well, and I was going to address that in the context of the timeline, because it's important to understand that first the class was certified, then in February of 2006, 4 months after the certification, a motion was made to amend the complaint to assert individual damages claims and to bifurcate those claims. And that was because, of course, we had a B2 class, injunctive relief only, no damages. So that motion to amend and add damages claims and to bifurcate was granted on June 9 of 2006. The class notice then goes out in May of 2007. In June of 2000, Mr. Hicks settles his individual bifurcated damages case. And as Mr. Gregory indicated, in the fall of 2007, class counsel on behalf of Mr. Hicks and the plaintiff class is involved in further investigation regarding the adequacy of the notice and the mailings and the high rate of undeliverable. And a second notice is mailed out, this time yielding a 12.6% undeliverable rate. So the timeline demonstrates that if anybody thought that Mr. Hicks was dismissing the entire case, we certainly wouldn't have been taking action on behalf of the plaintiff class, and in fact we were. What was dismissed was only his individual damages claims. Now, unfortunately, we don't have an order that specifies we are dismissing only his claims, not this case. But I think in the context of Rule 23, that's necessarily going to be the case.
Well, because let me ask a narrower question. Why isn't the order dismissing his, dismissing him from the case preclusive of his continuing to act as a class rep?
Because his individual damages claims added after the class certification and bifurcated from the class claims were dismissed, not the class action.
No, that's not, that's a little different question I'm asking. Let's assume I agree with you that the dismissal did not terminate the class action. Why doesn't the dismissal terminate his status as a class rep?
Well,
unless something in the stipulation of dismissal or the court's order provides otherwise.
Well, nothing in the stipulation of dismissal or the court's order provides otherwise.
Okay, then why isn't he out as a class rep?
Because he is still, because he is still acting, serving in that capacity. His, the dismissal of damages claims hasn't mooted his role as the class representative for purposes of the B2 class that was certified. He's still serving in that capacity.
Aren't there many, mostly federal cases that indicate that where a class rep settles individual claims, that's a presumptive basis for substituting in a new class rep, often at the request of class counsel?
It can be, Your Honor, but those cases primarily involve situations where the class rep's individual claim is the same, it's consonant with the class claims.
Okay.
In this case, they're diametrically opposed because this was a B2 class and only injunctive relief, no damages were permitted. So the dismissal of his damages claims does not handicap his ability to continue to act as one overseeing the now completed reformation, but the notice of that reformation. It in no way impacted his ability to do that. And
right.
And I don't believe the cases suggest otherwise.
Okay, I thank you for your answer, and your time is exhausted.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try and address the points that were raised specifically in the short time I have left. Judge Richmond, in reviewing my notes, I would believe we had we're under 24A as a matter of right on intervention because of the disposition of the action. Action may impair or impede the movement's ability to protect her interest. I think that was our predicate as opposed
also.
Well, once again, we find ourselves in what I consider the ultimate conundrum. By virtue of knowing that, and we had three clients, that they have a right to proceed, it might well be argued that there's nothing to be impaired. And then the only rhetorical question I can pose back to the court is, when is someone going to come to court and not know they're in court? And I don't mean to be glib about that, but who's going to protect the absent, the interest of the absent class members, other than someone who is sufficiently well advised that they now have a right to proceed to court?
But that's not what 24A
is. Well, and then it's, and then it may well be B, Your Honor, and that's I guess that's the only way to approach that. Judge Webb, I went through my notes. I thought I had some references to American Pipe and Construction versus Utah. I apologize that I do not. I reviewed it recently and noted that one of the sections in there addressed what I thought was a situation rather aptly, where it said, why indeed would you want to seek intervention prior to this development, because it was only when they dismissed the case that we had a right to seek intervention. But remember, American Pipe involves post denial of certification filing of motions to intervene. So that's as much as I can say about that without having the text, but I thought it dealt with this situation. You know, one of the curious things about the argument that I think the court heard, and I have just seconds left, is that you've heard a lot of rhetoric about attempts to try and keep the class going, but once again, nothing saying that after they settled the case and the class rep was presumptively ineligible or inadequate, and perhaps leveraging a settlement, they dismissed a case on July 20th, 2007. We filed within 6 months of that. But the case law says we're here to, you have to view that contextually. And in the context of seeking intervention, it's because that's the very problem. Nobody's getting the notice that they're required to get. And so we find ourselves once again in that conundrum where how are we supposed to protest as to what's going on when we don't know what's going on. And I would endorse the court once again when it mentioned the fact that there was no Rule 23E resolution of this, whether by fairness hearing or submission to the court of the adequacy of the settlement and the voluntary dismissal. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of all counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course. We are now going to take a short recess because we have some visitors scheduled to arrive.